Well, I'm proud to bring you our next guest, Ross Hemsworth. Why? Because he was once a skeptic. He went out to prove something, and he proved it to himself. We'll be back with Ross in a moment because he wanted to bring science to paranormal research. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Yes, to the United Kingdom we go. Ross Hemsworth is a business entrepreneur, co-owner of Glastonbury Radio, a very well-known paranormal radio and television presenter, scientific investigator of anomalous phenomena. He's on the advisory board of the Exopolitics Institute, very successful speaker, author of a book called The Dead Are Talking. Ross tours the world, talking about the growth of spirituality and science's more open-minded approach to the paranormal. And I love his topics, dowsing, earth energies, their effect on ESP and telepathy, soul survival, orbs, and of course, he is an expert on the Knights Templar, Ross Hemsworth. Hey, Ross, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Good to be with you.
Scanning the globe with you. It's good to have you.
Thank you very much. Good to be on your show.
Hey, let me ask you, you know, about a week and a half ago, the Vatican released a huge report about the Knights Templar. What did you think of that report?
I thought it was about time, well overdue. For many, many years, the Knights Templar have been persecuted for crimes that most people knew they didn't commit. And it was good to see the Vatican finally stand up and say it, but it's taken a long time.
You know, I knew they were wealthy, the Knights Templar, but I didn't realize just how powerful and strong they were.
No, the Templars were actually one of the first, well, probably the first, to put a banking system into place, and they had what would have been sort of, for that time, the likeliness of a credit card sort of system that they were using. So they developed a large amount of wealth through the banking system, I believe.
Do you think there are any Templars alive today in some
capacity?
Yeah,
there's Templar organizations all over the world, but most of the ones I've found so far don't run to the original ethic as closely as perhaps they should do. But my own research shows that the Templars actually started in Scotland in the 6th century and not in France in the 13th, as history states.
Tell me about Glastonbury Radio. How do people get an opportunity? Can they hear you here in the States?
Yeah, they can. We're online at glastonburyradio.net. And it's a wonderful station because it's totally esoteric. So it deals with all the esoteric New Age things, from music to talk. We have some great psychics and tarot readers on the station doing their own shows. We've got my show, obviously, which goes out on Friday nights, which is totally paranormal and UFO-related. And based on yours, really, we followed your example and your lead.
Well, good for you. And, you know, if there's anything we can do, Ross, down the line to help you in what you do with that, you just let us know. I mean, we'll promote as much of it as we can in this country with this vast audience, because I'd love to expose them to all the experts and all the good broadcasters, and you're one of them.
That's brilliant. Thank you for that, George. Well, maybe one day I can get on and do a show on Coast to Coast with you as well.
That would be fun. It really would. Now, how did you get interested in this area?
Now, this is a strange one. I used to run a television company making programs for the main broadcasters over here in the UK. And a police officer walked into my office one day in full uniform and said, "Mr. Hemsworth, Mr. Ross Hemsworth." And I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? And it turned out he's a part-time ghost hunter. And he said to me he wanted to take me along on a paranormal investigation. And I wasn't that keen. He was after making a TV series about ghosts. And I felt at the time that most evidence had been shown on telly, if indeed there was any, and that it wasn't really, you know, an idea that I wanted to follow. But he persuaded me. And I went along on this first ghost hunt with him. And it was totally prehistoric, George. You know, the guys were sitting on the floor in this dark, damp house with a sort of notepad and pen and a torch, waiting for Fred the ectoplasm to walk through the wall and say, "Hi, I'm Fred and I'm dead, case proven, we can all go home." And of course, you know, it's not like that. So it sort of got me interested. And I thought, well, there must be another way to deal with this subject. And maybe sort of a scientific approach, new equipment, taking it into the 21st century. And that's what I did.
Now, you're sitting down for this one, Ross. You talk about synchronicity. Mm-hmm. A long time ago in a far-off land, I was producing television programs in this country.
Right.
And into my office walked an individual who wanted to produce police programs. Look how close this is. And I said, "What do you mean you want to produce police programs?" He said, "I want to do training programs on television for police departments all around the country and fire departments and train them. You know, if there's a big fire or a horrible police shooting, I want to be able to go there to the scene and train police officers." So while he was doing that, he started telling me about his interest in ghosts. Now, I've always been interested in the paranormal, but just hearing you talk about you did TV programs and then walked a police officer, synchronicity is very strange these days, isn't it?
It is, very much so. You just never know what's going to happen. And synchronicity is a big word in paranormal circles these days. So many people use it because of the things that happen to them in their lives, which go well, well beyond the realm of coincidence, I believe.
You were not a believer in the beginning at all.
No, not at all. I was a skeptic, open-minded, but definitely skeptic. I really didn't believe ghosts existed. I didn't believe in an afterlife. I thought when we die, that's it. We go in a box, and that's the end of it, really. So I was somewhat surprised what the next few years were to open up to me.
So I assume you were not very spiritual then either. I find that most people who are skeptical are not very spiritual.
No, I don't believe I was. I was brought up to go to church when I was a kid, and I think sometimes when you're a child and you're pushed into the church, you actually rebel against it as a teenager, which is exactly what happened with me. I decided that the church was there to police the people. It was a set of rules. You know, every time you walk through a church door, you've got to enter into a contract to do certain things and live a certain way. I didn't feel comfortable with that contract, and I walked away from it. And I suppose for many years, I wasn't so much an atheist. I just didn't believe, and I thought, well, you know, somebody somewhere is going to prove something to me one day, I'm sure. And sure enough, they did.
So you were more agnostic, looking for the answers, and then they came.
Yeah, I think this is it. I think a lot of people go out there open-minded looking for answers. And I did what most people do. I went through various different churches like the Baptist, the Methodist, Church of England, spiritualist churches. I tried various different routes to see if there was anything that appealed to me and that I felt that I fitted into. But there wasn't really. You know, they all seemed to preach the same message, and I didn't feel that that message was right. I felt there was something strongly missing in that message. So I continued to search, you know, and I looked at the Islamic thing. I looked at so many different types of religion, and none of them stacked up. And then somebody said to me one day, do you realize, Ross, everybody has a piece of the jigsaw, and only when you collect those pieces of the jigsaw can you gather the truth.
Now, what was it that really stopped you from being the skeptic that you were? What changed your mind? Was it over time? Was there a major event? What was it?
I think it was a number of events, to be fair. I don't think there's any one thing that sort of made me stop and say, that's it, I now believe. But if there was one, it was while we were filming the TV series Ghost Detectives here in the UK. I was at a place called Bowden House down in Devon. And we were filming a reconstruction of an 8-year-old girl who had died in the particular room of the house called Alice. And we got a girl dressed up. She looked quite like the picture of Alice. She was dressed up in a Victorian-style dress and was skipping around the room. And we had three cameras, different points of the room, pointing around to film her. And all of a sudden, I heard as clearly as you're hearing me now, "May I play?" in my right ear. I went white as a sheet, apparently. I turned around, scuffled in the corner, to which point the cameras turned on me to see what was going on. I obviously wouldn't say anything in front of the cameras because I thought, no, I'm going to look a fool. I'm hearing voices, you know, I'm no way. And Graham, who was the police officer I told you about, said he sort of interviewed me for about half an hour, asking me the same question over and over again in different ways, as the police do, you know, typical interrogation. And at the end of it, he said, the one thing that doesn't change in Ross's story is the term "may I play." He said, now if he'd have said, "Can I play? Can I join in? Can I have a go?" I'd have thought, no, no more of it. But "may I play" is Victorian grammar. He said, kids don't speak like that in England anymore. I believe what Ross heard was the voice of the real Alice, who wanted to join into the recreation we were doing here filming today.
And once you started to believe, once those barriers, Ross, that you had put up there were beginning to crumble, how did you react to it?
I guess, again, it was over a period of time, because the thing that made Ghost Detectives so popular over here was that 90% of the time I would always come up with a rational and logical explanation for what happened. So when I did actually go to screen and say, well, I have to put this down in the little black book we call paranormal, the audience got really excited because it was like, oh, Ross can't answer it, you know. So it became almost my job to try and dismiss the evidence that was being put forward. But so much was happening within the shows as we were recording them that, you know, I had to turn around in the end and just say, well, look, you know, there is something out there that doesn't fit into this little box we all like to call normal.
Did you find, Ross, that people were more receptive to the fact that you were beginning to believe in the paranormal, the unusual, rather than just be the old skeptic saying, not true, not true, not true?
Yeah, well, I think when we made this series, we're talking 6 years ago now in 2001, and I don't know what it was like in 2001 in the US, but over here in the UK, it was still very skeptic governed. Most of the shows.
Well, everything was fine here until 9/11 in that horrible year. And then up until then, I don't think people believe much of anything anymore, Ross, but that's another story.
No, I can imagine that. I can imagine that. It's a sad thing. But no, I mean, I guess that because there'd been so many skeptics on telly, you know, it was a case of trying to do things a slightly different way with Ghost Detectives. And I think what happened was we were running out of skeptics as the series went on, because even Graham Matthews, the police officer, was a skeptic, although he was a ghost hunter part-time. He was very much a skeptic. And even he admitted to being a believer about four shows into the series, because things happened to him that he couldn't understand, couldn't believe, that sent him white as a sheet. And that was at the Theatre Royal in Margate. And, you know, I think as we went on, we really did just run out of skeptics.
Did you then begin to start believing other issues and other cases after the initial push?
I've never been one for believing anything unless I see it with my own eyes or experience it. I'm still fairly skeptical on certain things now because they haven't happened to me. But certainly as the paranormal opened up to me, I realized there were things that go on in this universe we don't understand. And I think Arthur C. Clarke once said, the universe isn't only stranger than we imagine, it's stranger than we can imagine. And I think this is it. There's a difference between the brain, which is meant for our existence here on Earth, and the mind, which taps into this universal conscious stream. And it's not until we start to explore that through the mind that we can maybe get into some of this really weird stuff that goes on around us from every single day.
Did you find that you would start trying to seek out scientists or paranormalists or experts in these chosen fields to help give you the information you were looking for?
Yeah, I certainly did. I went on a sort of global trek, really, looking for people that were like-minded, that were open-minded enough within science. And again, back in 2001, that was difficult. A lot of scientists didn't want to know. They said the paranormal was just a load of old tosh. We don't want to deal with it. So it was a struggle to start with. But then all of a sudden, people like Professor Gary Schwartz came into the picture at the University of Arizona, Dr. Sam Parnier at Southampton General Hospital. People that were renowned within their field started to take an interest in the paranormal. And I thought, now we're getting somewhere. And I had meetings with these various people. And we started to develop a worldwide network of people, people like Victor Zammit in Australia, various different people around the globe that had got evidence to bring forward. And I thought, now the evidence is just getting too strong. It's there. You know, it's time to pretty much go global with this thing, you know?
But it was always there, Ross. That's the thing. It was always real.
Mm. I think you're right. I think it always was. I think most of us go into this life knowing it's real. As a baby, as a child, you hear kids talking to invisible people all the time. But by the time you get to 5 or 6 years old and you're sent to school, it's all bashed out of you by the system. You know, the system tells us that it's wrong to believe in this. We'd be ridiculed for it. We get our religious education at school, which tells us, you know, don't trust familiar spirits. And all of this is the occult, which is a much misunderstood word, I think, around the world. So by the time we leave school at 16, 17 years old, we've lost that ability we had as a child, and we become almost global-driven skeptics, really, by the way the education system treats us.
Did you find that a lot of these topics that you have studied now, the parallel dimensions, the dowsing, the ESP, the telepathy, the soul survival, did you find that they're all interconnected?
Yes, very much so. There's a connection with all of these things together, as there is between UFOs and ghosts. And my work has sort of taken me across so many different areas. I mean, one interesting one, you mentioned there dowsing. I met a dowser when I was at the Pengersic Castle in Cornwall, which is supposed to be Britain's most haunted building. And the dowser there showed me that ley lines and energy lines were actually totally different things. You could put down a ley line yourself and pick it back up again. And we actually did this in test to show other dowsers who didn't believe. And in fact, I've done lots of lectures now to dowsing clubs all around the world, because dowsers tend to, every single one you meet has a different reason or a different explanation for how dowsing works. But most of them still believe that ley lines and energy lines are the same thing. So I went out there and I did the demonstration. I actually physically put down a ley line. I sent people out the room, got them to come back in and dowse, and they'd find a ley line where there wasn't one before. So it sort of opened my mind to it, and I realized that dowsing could also be used to track spirit on an investigation, so that we could dowse an area and know exactly where to put the cameras up to catch the best paranormal footage, and it worked.
You know, we talk about parallel universes. You have interviewed David Icke. We have on a regular basis Lionel Fanthorpe on the show, Philip Gardner, a lot of people that we have both dealt with over the years cross paths with us And I think they've helped convince us about what might be there on the other side or in other planes of existence.
Yeah, now this is an interesting one because David Icke, of course, 10 years ago in England was totally ridiculed on the front pages of the newspapers because he said he was the son of God. Now, probably if he'd have made the same statement today, he might not have been ridiculed in quite the same way because we're all sons of God in our own way. And I think it was the way he said it. But if you look at some of Icke's evidence, although some of it is still a little bit out there for most people, there's a lot of stuff now that's coming right through to the front. And people are saying, well, actually, Icke was right about this. Icke was right about that. So I think that's interesting. And Lionel Fanthorpe, Lionel and I are good friends. We go back a long way. And every time we get together for a meal or whatever, Lionel always says, you know, you're always that one step ahead of me with this Knights Templar stuff, and it's amazing what you come up with. And when I told him about the Templars originating in Scotland, he just went, well, you won't believe, Ross, that I'm on exactly the same track. But, you know, once again, you've pipped me at the post.
Isn't he one of the greatest storytellers ever?
Lionel's fantastic, and for anyone that doesn't know Lionel, he drives a Harley-Davidson motorbike, he wears leathers, he's a big muscular guy, he's a black belt in karate, and yet he's an ordained Anglican priest, but he's also head of Bufora, the UFO organisation, he's head of one of the big ghost clubs here in England, he's probably the most open-minded ordained priest I've ever come across in my life.
Great energy, Ross, doesn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. And he's one of the great investigators. I mean, some of his books, you know, are absolutely must-have reading for anyone that's interested in this stuff because he's just got a tremendous way about going about his research. And you tend to believe what he tells you. You know, unlike some investigators where you read it and you're not convinced at the end of the book, I think with Lionel, he always puts every side of the story in such a way that you put the book down thinking, that's got to be right.
One of my favorite stories that he gives us, and he's on about twice a year on the program, Spring-Heeled Jack. The way he says it, the way he does it, you know, with his deep voice, and he goes, and he jumped across the wall. And he's just fantastic. Great guy, too.
Wonderful storyteller. He used to present a lot of TV shows over here in England, things like Bloody Towers, which is all about castles and this sort of thing, and also 4TN TV, which is based on the 4TN Times magazine. And he is an absolutely wonderful storyteller. And why he's not still on telly over here, I just don't understand.
How was David Icke doing? I heard that someone was out to take advantage of him, take his books. Is he doing okay?
Yeah, I've got David back on my show at the end of November, and I'm really looking forward to it because he's got some new stuff coming up that he wants to release on the program, which is wonderful. I know the last time I spoke to David, he was having some problems, some issues with people that had been ripping him off and ripping some of his ideas off. And again, you know, there was a trace towards going to court. Whether it's gone that far, I don't know. But certainly he'd sort of gone undercover for a while whilst all of this was going on. But I think David's used to being attacked now in all sorts of ways. But he always puts it down to the fact that people are trying to stop him in his tracks from the work he's doing and what he's exposing.
Ross, we're going to keep you for 2.5 hours more here. It's a long program, but there's a lot to cover with you. The Dead Are Talking. How do we get the book here in the United States?
Right, it's on a website called hiddenmysteries.com, and you can just search the TGS authors there, and you'll find my name comes up, and that links directly to where you can buy the book online. And the book sort of documents my whole story, so as well as showing the paranormal research and making people think again about what might cause the paranormal, it also tells the problems that I've encountered along the way, because paranormal research has taken me through a near suicide, it's taken me through a divorce, I lost my kids, you know, everything went wrong in my life. And of course the church stood up and said, oh well, this is because you're dabbling with the occult. So it's an interesting read. It really does get in deep to get to know me and how I work.
Would you ever use a Ouija board, Ross?
No, I wouldn't. I've seen some bad experiences with people using Ouija boards, and if the clairvoyants are right about what they say, you open a doorway and unless you're trained, you may not know how to close it again, and you can let stuff through that perhaps might not be so good.
All right, when we come back, The Dead Are Talking. We'll also talk about parallel universes, get his take on dowsing, earth energy, ZSP, and yes, the other side. Last week, we're giving away the free CD of Al Bielek talking with Art Bell about the Philadelphia experiment. So do take advantage of that when you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter, when you renew as well. And also, I want you to know that a part of the proceeds will go to Al Bielek, but this is the last week for it, so take advantage of it. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Ross, what have you now concluded about the soul and about life after death?
Well, I suppose over the years, the different things that have happened to me have led me to believe there is some form of afterlife. I don't think there's a heaven and a hell as it's put to us by the church, but I think there are dimensions alongside of us, some of which are just normal living dimensions, but I also believe there are dimensions that the soul moves to that are almost like higher ethereal places that we move on to. But I also I'm starting to think that reincarnation is a possibility as well. I've had a couple of regressions in my life, and I've spoken to a lot of other people about regressions, including there's a whole chapter on that in my book. And I'm beginning to think that maybe some of us actually have more to do on this earth plane, if you like, and we are reincarnated into another body to go through it all again. And I think we get to a certain stage after so many lives on earth that we then transcend to this higher plane, this higher dimension.
I think you're right. You mentioned something about a meeting with a Dr. Sam, what is it, Parnier?
That's correct. Jenna, this is really interesting, George. Sam Parnier is a leading doctor at Southampton General Hospital in England, and he was working on near-death experience research, and he'd seen my website and was looking at pictures of orbs and various bits and pieces there. And he called me up and he said, look, you know, I was a skeptic, he said, when I started doing this. I believed, like most doctors, that near-death experiences were caused by serotonin in the brain and this sort of thing. He said, but I stumbled across something which I believe leads me to the same conclusion as you, and I'd like to meet. And he was telling me about the pictures that had been described to him by the patients of these glowing balls of light that happen at the point where they have this experience, and how the light then seems to transform into a body of some kind. And he said, I believe now that a soul or a consciousness leaves the body at the point of death. He said, and I think they do meet up with relatives who have passed on. And I thought that's a major conclusion from a doctor, someone like Parnier doing that work, to actually physically stand up there and say that. And he's since released a report saying that as well. So, well, you know, power to him, really.
Well, good for you. The parallel dimensions, Do you think that has anything to do with the afterlife?
Yes, I do. I believe that one or maybe more of the dimensions alongside of us is actually ethereal. So it's an interesting mix, because if something moves through a parallel dimension barrier, and I think as we get towards 2012, this barrier is getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and people transcend these barriers from time to time. So we may appear in their world, they may appear in ours. So an interaction is taking place between the different dimensions. And I think it's a really interesting time, because if we can actually learn how to do this so that we can do it at will, who knows what we'll find and what we'll discover in the years to come.
What do the scientists say that you've interviewed? Do they believe in that?
Well, yeah. I mean, even people like Stephen Hawking now are saying that there are multiple universes. I think they're still some way away from where we are with our sort of work, because it's a little bit too far for them to go. Science has a problem with admitting something that they don't fully understand, as you know. But one of the greatest problems with scientists is they don't say their sentence fully. What they should put on the end of every statement is science as currently understood. Because when you do a scientific experiment, you can come to a conclusion, but only by going through hypothesis, theory, multi-experiments can you come to a firm 100% conclusion. And even then, that experiment may change the next day and provide a different result. So I think if science was to stand up and say, well, there is no proof of this as currently understood, people would probably take them a lot more seriously, because we've seen so many programs on television in recent years that have shown science from the 70s, 80s was wrong, and they're actually changing now. I mean, we're hearing about the string theory. When it started off, the string theory said there were seven dimensions alongside of us. That then went up to 12 and then to 13. I think it's currently at 23. So they're getting there, but they're getting there very slowly, if you see what I mean.
It's probably unlimited, Ross.
I think so. There's an interesting quote in the Bible, and as you know, George, I'm not a religious person, but it says, in my Father's house there are many mansions. And I've always thought that perhaps that relates to the fact of, in this universe there are many different dimensions.
Or planets.
Yeah.
Or planets. You're right. No, it's got a number of interpretations. It means something. There's no doubt about that.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. It's an interesting area as well. It's an area we're doing a lot of study in right now. And in fact, I'd like to tell you about a story that something that happened to me at a pub called the Lily Arms in Bedfordshire.
Sure.
A woman called us in. It was quite a funny story because you've probably heard of people claiming that they want their house exercised. And
yes, of course.
This lady rang me up from this pub. She was a landlady of the Lily Arms, and she said, "Ross, I want you to come in and exercise a ghost." So quite jokingly, I said, "Well, okay, I'll bring a treadmill down. You know, we'll give you ghosts some exercise for you. Not a problem." And she said, "No, you don't understand." I said, "Yes, I do." I said, "But I'm being jocular on this purely because I don't believe we have any right to send somebody away who may have had more right to that premises than you and was probably there before you." So we went down to do the investigation, and the way she described this gentleman was as a Victorian dressed gentleman sitting in the corner reading a very old-fashioned newspaper, and he would always appear just as the pub was closing in the corner. So we set some cameras up, and we got her to go across and talk to this ghost. We said, "Have you ever spoken to it before?" She said, "No." I said, "Why not?" She said, "Well, it's a ghost." I said, "Yes, but you'd speak to anyone else that was sitting in your pub who shouldn't be there, wouldn't you?" So she said, "Yes." I said, "Well, then speak to him. Ask him what he's doing in your room." So just after the pub closed and everyone had gone, we turned the lights down very, very low, and she walked across the corner. She said, he's here. And at that point, we were getting moving orbs on the video. So we knew something was going on in the corner. We were also getting the temperature drop. The EMF meter started to go off. And she said, "Right." She said, "He's here. I'm going to speak to him." She said, "Could you tell me what you're doing in my room, please?" And then she went white as a sheet and ran from the room. And we said, What happened? She said, "He spoke back to me." I said, "Well, wouldn't you expect that to happen?" She said, "Yeah, but it was a bit of a shock." So I said, "What did he say?" He said, "Madam, I think it is my room and you are the intruder."
I love it.
So who had most right to be there? And was he, in fact, alive in a parallel dimension, a parallel universe? Was he actually there alive, or was he the ghost of someone from our past? So it got me looking at the whole dimension thing, George, because I thought to myself, this actually makes a lot more sense. He's living, he's now, he's there. You know, is he actually a dead person, or is he someone living in a multiple dimension?
How do you explain, Ross, the crossover, the overlap?
That's an interesting one. Again, I think as time progresses, a lot of clairvoyants have told us that between now and 2012, we're going to become much closer to the ethereal dimensions. And in fact, there's a lot more things happening now. We're getting more UFO sightings than ever before. We're getting more apparitions and ghost sightings than ever before. More and more people are coming forward saying they've had an experience now, which they probably wouldn't have talked about some years ago. I think that overlap is moving as the Earth shifts into a new paradigm. I think what's happening is the two things are lining up a little more than they were before, and we're able to cross that barrier and transcend these dimensions. And I think that will happen more and more as we go further towards 2012.
Tell me a little bit about the title of the book, The Dead Are Talking. I assume it's because of these crossovers that we've been talking about.
Yeah, the idea of the title came about because of the conversations with the dead, if you like, or if we, you know, I use the term the dead. Of course, we're talking about people that have ascended to a new form of life and possibly people that aren't dead at all, that are in other dimensions. But these conversations have taken place through clairvoyance. I've had my own clairvoyant experiences. Bearing in mind, as I said at the start of the show, I was a skeptic. I was actually quite amazed when I started to have conversations, if you like, myself, and was channeling things for other people. That was really strange to me, and I didn't feel comfortable with that at all at first. It was something I had to really grow used to. But the title came about that, really, conversations with things that we don't understand. So that's how I sort of came up with that title.
Ross, if total skepticism would be, let's say, 0%, total belief at 100%, when you were a skeptic, where would you be on that order?
I'd have been down in the 20%. You know, I'd got an open mind, but I was very, very skeptical. There were certain things that had happened to me as a child that I thought I couldn't explain at the time. So there was always this element in there of, well, I wonder what that was. But I'd convinced myself pretty, I would say 80%, that, you know, it was logically and rationally explainable.
All right, now where are you?
Probably 95%, I would think.
Really? That's dramatic.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, so much has happened, George, in the last sort of 10 years that I couldn't dismiss it now even if I wanted to. There's been too much evidence put in front of me. And it always makes me laugh when I get skeptics come up to me and say, oh, near-death experiences are just serotonin, or orbs are just dust and moisture. And I, you know, these days I don't try to convince the skeptics. I just say to them, you know, one day you'll see the truth, and move away, because there's really no point now. They have to go through what I went through to get to that area of understanding. Nobody listening to this show is just suddenly going to be convinced that the paranormal exists purely because I'm on here saying so. They need to go through these experiences. They need to see what I've seen, experience what I've experienced. And maybe by reading the book, they'll get a feel for that and understand new ways they can go about their own research to experience what I've experienced.
Do you believe that the other side is merely another plane of existence, but it's also scientific? It could one day be explained scientifically?
Yeah, I would hope so. And I think, again, that we go some way towards that with the work we've done. We're starting to explain some of these things now and put forward new concepts. When I do my lectures around the world, I always get loads of people come up to me afterwards and say, Ross, you've totally changed my thinking on the paranormal. Thank you so much for what you said today. And I don't only talk on the paranormal. I talked last weekend and the weekend before for the Awaken the Divine Feminine conferences in Dublin and London. And it was a room full of predominantly women talking about Mary Magdalene and all sort of post-Da Vinci Code stuff. And I put across my theories as to why those feminine energies are quite so strong right now. And again, I didn't know quite how my talk would go down in that sort of environment, but people are becoming far more open. They're listening now and they're understanding and they're all collecting their own pieces of the jigsaw, which is great.
Well, the dead are talking indeed. Tell me about some of your lectures, because you have a story that I want you to share with us about a crashed car.
Yeah, sure. This is something I tell at all the lectures that I do around the world. If you can imagine, George, God forbid, when you leave the show today, you go home and you have an accident on the road, your car gets in a bad accident. God forbid that never happens.
I'm always aware of that, too, believe it or not, because of the hours.
Exactly. We all do. You know, we work very late at night and sometimes the concentration's not there. But God forbid this happens to you. You walk away, you're fine, there's no injury, but your car is a wreck. Now, your car will go to the scrapyard, as we call it here in England, and they'll squash the car into a 3-foot cube. You'll never see that car again. But the guy that owns the scrapyard's a bit clever. He'll take the engine out of the car if it's still working, and he'll sell that to somebody else. So that power source then goes into a different vehicle. Now, if you saw that that engine going down the interstate the next day, you wouldn't recognize it because it's now inside a new body, a new car. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. Now, if you can imagine the afterlife being the same thing, that if there was reincarnation or if you came back as a spirit, you would come back as this ball of energy, which is not recognizable because the human body goes into a box at the point of death and it's either burnt or buried. So why should we come back looking exactly the same way as we did before? So people that are looking for this full body apparition, this you in ghost form, I think they've got it wrong. I really do believe, having seen apparitions myself, that isn't quite the way it works. So if we liken this to the car and the engine and just try to imagine ourselves, our energy source being transformed into a different shape, a different vehicle, then just maybe it throws new light on what we're seeing when we see what we like to call a ghost.
So in terms of investigations, as you slowly evolve to become a believer, and I want to talk about ghost detectives again, too, in a second. Did you have special equipment? Did you listen to EVP sounds? Did things like that really push you over the edge, other than that one episode we talked about?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And what was happening was we were talking to clairvoyants. Clairvoyants were telling us what was going to happen in what room and when. And in one particular occasion, I actually tried it myself. And I said, look, you know, this is a TV show. If we don't get some paranormal activity, they may cancel the show. Spirit, we need your help. Can you help us?
Please,
and a clairvoyant came up to me 10 minutes later and said, Ross, I've just had a message for you from Spirit. Now, this clairvoyant was in a different part of the building and had no idea that I'd asked Spirit this question. And she came over to me, she said, Ross, I've got this message for you. Spirit said, the orbs will dance for you tonight in the big room. Now, we didn't know what that meant at the time, but sure enough, later that night, we had some incredible stuff go on in this room with both orbs caught on video in exactly the place where the clairvoyant had told us to set the cameras up. And we also had the most incredible piece of footage with a candle, where the flame of the candle leaves the candle. It rises about 3 inches into the air, away from the wick of the candle, continues to burn, then goes out, and then a few seconds later, ignites and drops back down, 3 inches back down to rejoin the candle again. I've never seen anything like it in my life, and I still to this day have been unable to explain it. So, yeah, I mean, it does. We certainly get those pieces of information come through that help us to be able to do the work we do.
That's good work, necessary work. How many people are out there who are doing the work, but they're not doing it right, Ross, and they're hurting quality investigations?
Unfortunately, quite a few. We have a program over here, which you may have heard of, called Most Haunted, which in some ways has done some good work in that it's got a lot of people interested in the paranormal, but it's also done some bad work and it's got perhaps the wrong sort of people involved. And we had a period just after Most Haunted went to air where loads of people were joining our organization and going out on hunts, but all they wanted to do was have some fun on a Saturday night, jump and go, you know, boo to everything and be scared every time something happened. And that was their fun. They didn't want to be part of any scientific tests. They found all that stuff boring. They just wanted the excitement of being in a dark house on what they call a ghost hunt. And I always start my lectures by saying, they call me a ghostbuster. I've honestly never busted a ghost in my life.
Will the TV series ever get into the United States?
I certainly hope so. Although what happened, there was a digital channel over here called UK Horizons, which folded a couple of years ago, and it sort of went into deep archive, and I'm not 100% sure that they're ever going to do anything with it, which is a real shame because it was a groundbreaking series. It came out before Most Haunted, and it was fronted by former Doctor Who, Tom Baker. It was a really, really strong show. There were 6 one-hour episodes. Each one spent 5 days and five nights in a venue rather than just going in for one night. We were there for the whole week at each place, and we went to the 6 most haunted places in Britain over the course of the series. It was an absolute groundbreaking show, so if anyone's listening from American TV, you really should contact UK TV in England, who hold the rights now, because this is a series, I'm sure, which would be absolutely magnificent in the States.
Oh, absolutely. England seems to be more haunted than the United States, maybe because of the age?
Yeah, I think a lot of that's to do with history. I'm not sure that it's more haunted, because my view now is that the paranormal is everywhere. You've just got to find it. You don't need to go into a haunted house to see a ghost. You know, you can bring a ghost to you.
Sure.
But I think because of its history, people assume that the old castles, the old big stately homes and manor houses are just right places for investigation. And in fact, this weekend, I'm taking my team into a place underneath Glastonbury Tor to do an investigation, which we're really looking forward to, because it's supposed to be the gateway to the underworld, they say.
Oh, really? Are you ready for that? What if you open up a portal, Ross?
I don't know if I'm ready for it, because I've not been on one of these investigations for a little while now. I've been so busy with other projects here, but it's certainly going to be a good one. The legend of this place is amazing, and a lot of the stories, things that have happened to people there, are almost unbelievable. So it's going to be a good one, and I think we're going to enjoy it. But we'll go into it the same way as we go into most of ours. We'll go into it scientifically, with the right equipment and with the right protection around us.
Tell us a little bit about the story around that.
Yeah, the story, Glastonbury Tor, has been associated with many, many things, including the Holy Grail. There's a very strong story that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were in fact married and came to live in Glastonbury after the crucifixion, that Jesus didn't die on the cross at all. So it would probably explain why there's hundreds of thousands of people every year make a spiritual pilgrimage to the town, because there is a strange energy here in Glastonbury that's unlike anything anywhere else I've ever been in the world. And the area underneath the Tor is called the White Spring. And the White Spring is a fresh water source that runs underneath Glastonbury Tor. Now, we do know that when the abbey was burnt down in the times of King Henry VIII, the monks actually ran through tunnels out from underneath the abbey towards the Tor. And it's quite possible that any artifacts that were buried in the abbey would have been taken there. Now, on the site of where Glastonbury Abbey now stands used to be the original Wattle Church, which was said to have been built by Jesus himself in the first century and dedicated to his mother, the Virgin Mary. And there are certain things that indicate there may be some truth in this, from writings, from archaeological digs at the abbey, the names Jesus Maria inscribed in the wall in the 11th century, marking a point which is also marked with mason's marks on the other side of the stone. There's also the work of Frederick Bligh Bond in or around 1900, where he was telling stories of exactly what would be found on each of his digs a week or two before he did them, stating there would be a tunnel here, there'd be a crypt there. Nobody knew how he could do that, but he got every single thing right. And then, of course, when he turned around and said, well, the reason I can do this is because I'm talking to the dead monks who are telling me where everything is, they declared him mad and took him off the case, so his work was never finished. So there's an amazing history and, I suppose, mystery being the right word to Glastonbury, and it's an area that I'm really looking forward to doing more investigation with.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM.